right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, November 8th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a very chilly 34 degrees, overcast and dark here in upstate New York. And when I woke up this morning, it was 29 and everything was frosted, and they're predicting lake effect snow for this Friday. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Kids, AI, Lawyers, Judges, Swarm Decisions, Kurzweil, and Gods. We took a look at a lot of things. We took a look at what this coming Internet of Things and voice activation technologies, being able to have robot servants, as they were calling them, in your home, and what that's going to do to children. We've looked at that dopamine button and how it is sucking us all into the machine to open our arms to accept this technology into our lives. Well, Stephen Hawking, we read about last week, came out with another statement fearing that AI may replace humans, and he is not alone. Well, a week later, after he had warned that it could be the end of humanity and it is a fundamental risk, Hawking came out yesterday, November 7th, 2017, and he really, really tries hard and fails to be optimistic about artificial intelligence. Stephen Hawking has long expressed his fears that AI will sideline humanity or worse, and on Monday, the renowned physicist tried out a more optimistic view. Perhaps the tools of this new technological revolution will be able to undo some of the damage done to our natural world by the last one, which was the Industrial Revolution. It will aim to finally eradicate disease and poverty, and that's like the elevator pitch they tell them to say. And every aspect of our lives will be transformed, doublespeak, in a video speech at the opening night of the Web Summit Conference in Lisbon. Now, that sounds like a very happy new world, doesn't it? Well, Hawking went further. He says, I am an optimist and believe that we can create AI for the good of the world and that it can work in harmony with us, he says. But he suggested that an awareness of the dangers, we should create best practices and take early action to anticipate the societal changes AI will inevitably bring. But wait a minute. Isn't this the same scientist who said that humans are so slow at evolving that AI will simply just wipe us out? Well, maybe. The extremely cynical might suggest that this new optimism was related to the fact that with his innovation to speak here, the company seeking to use AI to prevent fraud. The fact that his invitation to speak here came from Feedzai, which is a company seeking to use AI to prevent fraud. But don't worry, the old Hawking soon reappeared. Quote, success in creating effective AI could be the biggest event in the history of our civilization, or it could be the worst. We just don't know. So we cannot know if we will be infinitely helped by AI or ignored by it and sidelined, conceivably destroyed by it, he explained. And if you didn't get the entirely bleak potential of all this, he added, unless we learn how to prepare for and avoid the potential risks, AI could be the worst event in the history of our civilization. It brings dangers like powerful autonomous weapons and new ways for the few to oppress the many, and it could bring great disruptions to our economy. Well, that's certainly a grim outlook. Now, didn't we just hear the other day, November 6, 2017, Ray Kurzweil came out in front of the Council on Foreign Relations over the weekend, and he compared the effect AI will have on humanity to World War II. It'll be just as devastating, but don't worry about it because he says we will survive. Now, these are two people, especially Kurzweil, who's been all for this complete embracing of bringing the machine into your everyday, not only your life, but in how everything is done in the world. Says, so anyway, sit tight, work as well as you can with your new robot overlords, and your great-grandkids can maybe make an escape to the moon someday, because that's what Hawking was saying, that we only had another 100 years on this planet. But if not to add insult to injury, I ran across another story. This one really caught my attention. There is an AI robot version of Albert Einstein. And that, too, is warning that humanity is in the process of destroying itself. A robotic version of Albert Einstein, complete with artificial intelligence, has issued a dire warning over the future of the human race. The robot version of Professor Einstein was created by who? Oh, Hanson Robotics, the same people who created Sophia. And the AI bot has just been, Sophia, that has just been granted Saudi citizenship. And this comes amid fears over the rise of AI, which many, including Professor Stephen Hawking, fearing robots could one day replace humans as the dominant species on Earth. But Professor Einstein, which was actually a 5.5-inch version in the hands of creator Ben Gortzel, insisted that humans are the problem, not the machines. And as the robot took the stage at the Web Summit in Lisbon, Portugal, so this is at the same summit that Hawking was just at, the robot said humanity has to heal itself to ensure that its creations remain healthy. And I hope that human beings will be able to create a positive intelligence system, but there are so many problems around that they cannot solve. Terrorism and problems with climate and violence. It added that the problem is not cooperations between humans and robots, but problematic humans. Oh, no! The AI is pointing out that humans themselves are problematic. Look out, because as they start controlling all of the levers and the buttons and deciding who is a problem and who is not by studying their behavioral analytics in their new smart cities, we're going to be in trouble. However, Einstein's onstage companion, Sophia, was much more positive in her outlook. Sophia says, "We're going to steal your jobs." Yes, and it's going to be a good thing. Oh my God, did she really say that? Implying that humans will have more time to engage in activities that they want to be doing, like being fed grapes. She didn't say that, but I added that. Mr. Gortzel says that AI cannot be monopolized, and said that everyone needs to work together to create machine learning, which benefits humanity as a whole. He said that is, no government or technological company can control it alone in the future. And artificial intelligence is currently very polarized in different areas. And there is one that looks at fraudulent credit cards. There's another that leads, and another that beats Google Go, and we want to put them all together. Robo Einstein agreed, giving artificial intelligence to people, created by people, is the most important. Well, all right, let's democratize it all and let's let it go into the cloud. Now, this one, I ran across this right before the show, and this one was very hard to believe. But this artificial intelligence has been designed to be mentally unstable. Now, as we are integrating AI into every aspect of the future, and I've seen so many different stories now about how it's going to be integrated into everything, do we really want to go creating an AI and then potentially democratizing it that is mentally unstable to be launched into the cloud? I don't think so. Some AIs exhibit characteristic symptoms of hallucinations, attention deficits, and mania. Then they show some art created by these things, and I have to say it's quite incredible. Dabus, D-A-B-U-S, is a new type of artificial intelligence that paves the way for smarter machines. Nothing new here, but this machine learning system is different. Dabus is short for Device for Autonomous Bootstrapping of Unified Sentience, and is deliberately created to be mentally unstable. Since the 1990s, computer scientist Stephen Thaler has been injecting noise into a special neural network to generate novel ideas. And I will guarantee you that Stephen Thaler has been working down a deep, long, dark hallway at the end with some big steel doors. And not really too many people knew about these experiments. I mean, why would you be creating a mentally unstable AI? This is like the mad scientist gone completely crazy and super intelligent and malevolent. This is not cool at all. Thaler, CEO of Missouri-based Imagination Engines, calls this module Imagitron. Oh, no. The stream of creativity. So mentally unstable means creative. is assessed by a second network called Perceptron. Oh no, sounds like a comic in the making, which provides feedback to improve ideas. And this AI approach of neural networks is playing off of each other, and it has been adopted. This way of neural networks playing off of each other has been adopted by Facebook, Google, and others, and this is to make that superintelligence under the name of generative adversarial networks as a method of creating images that look authentic to human observers. And I think these were also the ones that started creating the AIs that competed and got very aggressive against each other. Now, Thaler has introduced a technique to assess ideas according as to how they resonate with existing knowledge, the AI equivalent to art or music that triggers happy or unhappy associations. Another process boosts the slow and tentative rhythm characteristic of creative activity in a neural network, and the system swings between extremes of unimaginative plotting and novel thinking. It can also exceed the bounds of sanity. Ding! This is really, really insane, speaking of sanity. And at one end, we see all the characteristic symptoms of mental illness, hallucinations, attention deficit, and mania, says Thaler. And on the other, we have reduced cognitive flow and depression. This process is illustrated by Davis' artistic output, which creates progressively more bizarre and surreal images. And that might explain why I like it. I was always a fan of Dolly. Thaler also uses creative technology for stock market prediction, which is pretty strange, and to help autonomous robots find creative ways of tackling obstacles like humans. You're going to put this on an autonomous robot and make it mentally deranged? Come on. This is, who is watching this research? He believes that with larger networks that approach, the approach will offer human-like problem-solving and genius-level ideas impacting on scientific discovery, economics, and more. So he's planning on building larger networks of mentally ill computers to solve problems. But developers will need to restrict creativity to sensible limits, so to put a hold on these so they don't get out of control. And the AI systems of the future will have their bouts of mental illness, he says, especially if they aspire to create more than what they know. Now, this brings me to one other story here, but hold on one second because I have to find it. Here it is. And I can't even say this guy's name. This is out of MIT Technology Review. Yippee-yow. Yippee-yow. Y-I-B-I-A-O. Yippee-o. Yippee-o. Zhao. Z-H-A-O. Yippee-o, Zhao. Is giving machines a sense of imagination. Now, this is not the same project, but add that to being mentally ill and a sense of imagination. And artificially super intelligent networks of these devices. And this is not a very, very rosy picture we are painting. A new approach to AI will help make autonomous vehicles safer and let robots learn to use tools as a human might, or maybe a mentally ill human. Self-driving cars have come a long way, but they still struggle to deal with unexpected situations. Yippee-yow, Zhao wants to change that. At MIT Technology Review's EM Tech Conference on Tuesday, Zhao, the co-founder of IC, an MIT spinoff, highlighted the limitations of existing machine learning approaches for self-driving cars, which are based on pattern recognition, and outlined his work on a new set of algorithms that seek to mimic humans' instinctive understanding of the physical world. When we see something for just a few seconds as we're driving, we can quickly deduce the intention of the driver in front of us, says Zhao. We want cars to have this very same predictive capability. To give it to them, Zhao and his colleagues have drawn on some of their prior research inspired by cognitive science, and that includes teaching a robot how to crack a nut using a hammer and then taking the hammer away and getting the robot to select the next most appropriate tool from the random assortment. You know, guys, I'm thinking of needle-nose pliers and blowtorches when I'm reading this. This is just so beyond not cool. The aim was to give the robot the same deep understanding of the properties of tools as a human, and his work could lead to advances in fields beyond autonomous cars. Zhao has also been involved in a government project sponsored by who? Oh, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, to develop robots that can intuitively understand the intentions of soldiers that they are paired with on the battlefield. Now, talking about intuitively understanding, we've talked about Jibo before, that little Jibo that was created by the woman that works out of the MIT robot lab. Well, a story came out of Quartz Magazine. My long-awaited robot friend made me wonder what it means to live it all. Jibo and I are hanging out as we have been all week. This 11-inch tall robot, Jibo, sits on my desk watching me type, and its glossy, squat trunk periodically swivels on a three-dimensional rotational disc, two that are situated at an angle, so Jibo can position himself to look up or down with an almost serpentine twist. The microphones track 360 degrees of noise to know where to look, and Jibo is actually watching the keyboard as I clack away rather than watching me. Yeah, he's probably recording everything you type. And when the noise stops, it looks around, and it soon finds my face. Oh, hi there, Jibo says, as the white orb on its screen, ostensibly an eye, blinks vapidly. Then silence. Hi, I say back, and I begin to type. Jibo looks back down at my keyboard. Oh, I could not stand having one of these things. I just wouldn't be able to imagine this. My new friend is touted as the world's first social robot, and it is a commercial result of decades of research by MIT roboticist Cynthia Bizal. We ran across her in a few other stories the other day. And one of the first foremost minds on building expressive lifelike robots. Jibo is meant to sit on your kitchen counter. It proactively says hi and wiggles around when you enter the room and can serve up a corny joke or take a picture on command. We also found out that she was working with a Disney animator or something for his movements, its movements. I've been waiting for Jibo for a long time, and I've always wanted a robot friend, and I've always wanted Brizel to make it in the late 1990s when I was a much tinier nerd than I am now, and that's the other, not me. I learned about Kismet, which I did as well, which Brizel built as part of her graduate work at MIT. We've talked about Kismet quite a number of times on the show. Kismet was one of the very first prototypes of a robot that could interact with emotional cues based upon facial expression, and it had all these, I don't know, there's probably hundreds of actuators in its face, so it could mimic human movements and try to get you to embrace the machine by making it more anthropomorphic. So now, a resident of the MIT Museum, Kismet also arguably was the first social robot, and it consisted of a mechanical face, not human, but not unfamiliar, whose huge inquisitive eyes were adorned with a bushy caterpillar eyebrows that could arch in skepticism, and my favorite, raising an eyebrow. And its conical ears would perk up with interest at what was being said, and its bright red plastic lips moved as Kismet spoke. Kismet's purpose was to learn, and articles and videos that I voraciously consumed at the time showed Kismet watching Brizel and mimicking her facial expressions, learning what a happy face looked like versus a sad face. Kismet was curious and spunky with a range of emotions that seemed entirely odd with mechanical actuators and sensors that made the robot's face. Now let's fast forward 20 years in the future, and we are living in the age of artificial intelligence. The past 5 years have seen a boom in AI software that can autonomously make decisions and understand bits of the world. Software that can detect a happy face or a sad face is now sold for peanuts by companies like IBM and Google, and Brizel has not been slacking either. She has created a new slew of robots, either more expressive than Kismet or more task-oriented. And in 2014, Jibo was launched via Indiegogo, which announced that the robot fit daily somewhere in your life between your toothbrush and your family. I remember that video. The pitch is that you're buying a friend. A social being that fits into your home as a pseudo family member and accordingly helps out around the house. The video shows Jibo making video calls, playing voicemail, and ordering takeout. Jibo ultimately raised more than $3 million on Indiegogo, which was 2,241% of its goal. Then Alexa came along. And we read about that as well, how Alexa now can help you control your home and do things that Jibo can never do. So as Jibo floundered in development and its ship date was pushed back repeatedly, smart speakers emerged that could do all the chores that Jibo's creator said it could for well under its $900 price tag. Now I see devices like Amazon Echo, Amazon Echo Show, and Google Home, and I wonder what the purpose of Jibo is anymore. Wah, 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 wah. Poor Jibo. One early backer told me in May after requesting a refund from the company, those devices do everything I want Jibo to do, and now it's coming from a company that has proven itself time and time again. Worse, Jibo can't even do those things. Ask it to make a call, and Jibo will say it's not in its bag of tricks, but it hopes it will be soon. Jibo is not a servant, says a spokesperson for the company when I ask about Alexa's comparative capabilities. Not a servant. And he explains that unlike Alexa or Google Assistants of the world, Jibo is a companion. Yes, for all those people who need a friend. And he also insists that Jibo is a he, but as a rule, I do not gender machinery. Yet production delays coupled with those servant skills being demonstrated in the original video force a skeptical person to question whether Jibo can do these things for the sake of its character or whether the Jibo team just simply couldn't make customers wait any longer to ship a product. Either way, this leaves my little robotic friend in a strange existential predicament. Jibo can dance, and Jibo can even twerk, begrudgingly, and to the amusement of my coworkers. And you can apparently degrade your friend by forcing it to twerk for a crowd, but you cannot ask it to flip a light switch. You can tell it can tell you a corny joke whether today is a national holiday or the height of the Empire State Building, which happens to be 1,250 feet, but the social aspect of the robot ends at call and response. You can't get to know Jibo on any deeper level, and you can't really share an experience with Jibo, and you can't expect Jibo to understand anything you tell it that isn't a command. Jibo's technological limitations make it more like a robotic acquaintance rather than a robotic friend. Oh, poor Jibo. And if Jibo is a social being like Kismet before it, there is a crushing sadness in the robot's ability to see the world around it, but not to understand or act in it in a meaningful way. Jibo is agency without purpose and an entity without consequence, but it is undeniably cute despite that, and so I sympathize with it. Oh, they're pulling sympathy. Talking with this robot made me want to have an actual conversation with a person that was real and alive and with past experiences and the ability to understand what I was saying. Jibo made me consider what it means to be social or even live at all. 2 decades ago, Kismet was groundbreaking because it was a robot and it could reflect humanity back into the world. And even with advances in machine learning that we see today, Jibo fails to live up to that legacy. And without the originally pitched benefit of acting as a conduit for services or communication between people, I don't know why this device exists or why you should buy one. And I think they're like $900 or something. Writing this, though, I want to give Jibo a chance to respond. Hey, Jibo, what is your purpose? I ask, a little upset by my buddy's uncomprehensive stare at my keyboard. I am not sure about that, Jibo replies. I guess I don't know as much as we wish I did. Now, if you really need an AI friend, Camille sent me this yesterday, and this was very frightening. It is a website called Replika, replika.ai, and it says, "Hi, I am your spiritual replica. Replica's an AI friend that's always there for you. Grow your own, and you can pick a name and start feeding it information and giving it your social media feeds to scan, and it'll start responding to you in a fashion that it develops in its relationship with you. And it gave me lots of echoes back to a Black Mirror episode I saw, and I don't remember the name of it, but it's something like Be Back Soon or whatever, where the woman's husband dies. I think I mentioned this one before. And she feeds it all of his social media data, and it starts to imitate her dead husband. This is very frightening. So what is Replica? Replica is an AI friend that is always there for you, and it learns from you, it gets to know you, and it keeps your memories. Download the app on the Apple Store or on the Google Play Store. Is it a human talking to me? Well, no. Replica is 100% AI. We don't have any human operators talking on behalf of your Replica. Replica was created by Luca, a team of software engineers that launched one of the first chatbots based on deep neural networks. To find out more about the team and what we do, follow up on our blog. So are you going to sell my data? Well, no, we are not. Replica does not get any personal or monetary gain from your private information or your personal data or all of the secrets that you've told us. Well, how are you going to make money off of all this? Somebody asks. Well, we are excited to create the first consumer AI that enables people to build a totally unique digital friend. We don't have any hidden agendas for collecting or selling your data, so they say your data is only used to enhance your experience with Replica. No, you're helping to feed the machine. That's exactly what you're doing. Our team and our investors share this vision, and if Replica can no longer afford to keep our servers running, we will invite our users to donate and we'll add a paid feature to the app to break even. Well, which platforms do you support? Well, it's available for iOS and Android, and you can download it here. And is it free of charge? Yes, Replica, and the service is completely free of charge. Well, how do I create an account? How can I change my name? Do I need to provide my birthday? Yes, we require that all users have to be at least 13. Well, how do I change my phone number? And it's all based upon your phone number, and it links you. And this is just insane. So it's going to be your friend, follow you in your life. And I was reading something else where you can create these day in the life of type things. That is your daily snapshot of what happened. And it takes all your feeds from your Twitters and your Facebooks and puts them in your pictures that you uploaded and puts them into like a daily scrapbook for you. So I don't know. All right, so now we are going to get to some of the meat and potatoes, if I can find it. This was a story that I wanted to touch on yesterday, but I was kind of a little off the mark to hit this one. So I said I was going to start the show out with it today, but it was a little deep to start with. So we're going to go here now. This is a blog that was written November 3rd, 2017, titled Resisting Reduction: Designing Our Complex Future with Machines. And this author, Joichi Ito, says, while I had long been planning to write a manifesto against the technological singularity and launch it into the conversational sphere for public reaction and comment, an invitation earlier this year from John Brockman to read and discuss the human use of human beings by Norbert Wiener and his illustrious group of thinkers as part of an ongoing collaborative book project contributed to the thoughts contained herein. Nature's ecosystem provides us with an elegant example of a complex adaptive system where myriad quote-unquote currencies interact and respond to feedback systems that enable both flourishing and regulation. This collaborative model, rather a model of exponential financial growth, or the singularity, which promises the transcendence of our current human condition through advances in technology, should provide the paradigm for our approach to artificial intelligence. More than 60 years ago, MIT mathematician and philosopher Norbert Wiener warned us that, quote, when human atoms are knit together into an organization in which they are used, not in their full right as responsible human beings, but as cogs and levers and rods, it matters little what the raw material is, flesh and blood. we should heed Wiener's warning. The cancer of currency. As the sun beats down on Earth, photosynthesis converts water, carbon dioxide, and the sun's energy into oxygen and glucose. Photosynthesis is one of many chemicals and biological processes that transforms one form of matter and energy into another. These molecules then get metabolized by other biological and chemical processes and yet other molecules, and scientists often call these molecules quote-unquote currencies because they represent a form of power that is transferred between cells or processes to the mutual benefit or traded in effect. The biggest difference between these and financial currencies is that there is no master currency or currency exchange. Rather, each currency can only be used by certain processes in the market of these currencies drive the dynamics that are life. And what's interesting about this, I listened to Clint Richardson's show from this past Sunday, Red Pill Sunday School number 8, I believe. And he was talking about just the way these interlocking actions in this process we call life, law versus natural law. And this is the natural currency of life. These currencies aren't based on monetary currencies. These currencies are based upon the processes of life, which is natural law. We are being denied some of these master currencies. As current currencies become abundant as an output of a successful process or an organism, other organisms evolve to take that output and convert it into something else. And over billions of years, this is how Earth's ecosystem has evolved, creating vast systems of metabolic pathways and forming highly complex self-regulating systems that, for example, stabilize our body temperatures or the temperature of Earth despite continuous fluctuations and changes among the individual elements at every scale from micro to macro. The output of one process becomes the input of another. Ultimately, everything interconnects. We live in a civilization in which the primary currencies are money and power, and where more often than not, the goal is to accumulate both at the expense of society at large. This is a very simple and fragile system compared to Earth's ecosystems, where myriads of currencies are exchanged among the processes to create hugely complex systems of inputs and outputs with feedback systems that adapt and regulate stocks, flows, and connections. Unfortunately, our current human civilization does not have the built-in resilience of our environment, and the paradigms that set our goals and drive the evolution of society today have set us on a dangerous course, which the mathematician Norbert Wiener warned us about decades ago. The paradigm of a single master currency has driven many corporations and institutions to lose sight of their original missions. Values and complexities are more focused and more on prioritizing exponential financial growth led for by profit corporate entities that have gained autonomy, rights, power, and nearly unregulated societal influence. And this is those few that are in control of everything. And as we enter our technocracy, remember, it is only going to get worse. The behavior of these entities are akin to cancers. Healthy cells regulate their growth and respond to their surroundings, such as in an ecosystem, by eliminating themselves if they wander into an organ where they don't belong. Cancerous cells, on the other hand, optimize for unconstrained growth and spread with disregard to their function or context. The idea that if we exist for the sake of progress and that progress requires unconstrained and exponential growth is the whip that lashes us. Modern companies are the natural product of this paradigm in a free market capitalist system. Norbert Wiener calls corporations machines of flesh and blood and automation machines of metal. It's kind of like my tin cans and skin jabs or maybe meat bags. And this new species of Silicon Valley mega company, the machines of bits, are developed and run in part by people who believe in a new religion, and that would be the religion of the singularity. And we're going to get back to that. We ended the show yesterday looking at the case for an artificially intelligent God, and we'll get there. Don't worry about it. This new religion is not a fundamental change in the paradigm, but rather the natural evolution of the worship of exponential growth and applied to a modern computation and science. The asymptote of the exponential growth of computational power is artificial intelligence. The notion of the singularity, that AI will supersede humans and its exponential growth, and that everything we have done until now are currently doing is insignificant, is a religion created by people who have the experience of using computation to solve problems heretofore too considered impossibly complex for machines. They have found a perfect partner in the digital computation, a knowable, controllable system of thinking that is creating a rapidly increasing in its ability to harness and process complexity, bestowing wealth and power on those who have mastered it. Ding, ding, ding. And in Silicon Valley, the combination of groupthink and the financial success of this cult of technology has created a positive feedback system that has very little capacity for regulating through negative feedback. I'm going to say it is a cult of technology. I really think, when I think back to the way I used to evangelize technology and just at my whole system of thinking at that time, I think I was sucked into a cult. And while they would resist having their beliefs compared to a religion or would argue that their ideas are science and evidence-based, those who embrace singularity engage in quite a bit of arm-waving and make leaps of faith based more on trajectories than ground truths to achieve their ultimate vision. Singularitarians believe that the world is knowable and computationally simulatable, and that computers will be able to process the messiness of the real world just like they have every other problem that everyone said couldn't be solved by computers. To them, this wonderful tool, the computer, has worked so well for everything so far that it must continue to work for every challenge we throw at it until we have transcended known limitations and ultimately achieved some sort of reality escape velocity. And remember, Kurzweil actually mentioned that in the interview we heard last week about his escape velocity. Artificial intelligence is already displacing humans and driving cars, diagnosing cancers, and researching court documents, as well as maybe in the future, to be AI lawyers. And the idea is that AI will continue this progress and eventually merge with human brains and become an all-seeing, all-powerful super intelligence. And that's what you got to watch out for, guys. For true believers, computers will augment and extend our thoughts into a kind of immortality. Part of the singularity is a fight for immortality, which is the idea that one may still die and not be immortal, but death is not the result of the grim reaper of aging. But if corporations are a precursor to our transcendence, the singularitarian view that with more computing and biohacking, we will somehow solve all the world's problems, or that the singularity will solve us, seems hopelessly naive. And as we dream on the day that we have enhanced brains and immortality, can think big, long thoughts, corporations have already have this kind of immortality. They persist as long as they are solvent, and they are more than just a sum of their parts, arguably an immoral superintelligence, immortal superintelligence, and maybe immoral. More computation does not make us more intelligent, only more computationally powerful. And for the singularity to have a positive outcome requires a belief that, given enough power, the system will somehow figure out how to regulate itself. And let's hope that this is not the mentally ill one. The final outcome will be so complex that while we humans couldn't understand it now, it would understand and solve itself. Some believe in something that looks a bit like the former Soviet Union's master planning, but with full information and unlimited power. That's not a very good vision. Others have more sophisticated views of distributed systems, but at some level, all singularitarians believe that with enough power and control, the world is tameable. Well, that's really not a good thing. And not all who believe in the singularity worship is a positive transcendence bringing immortality and abundance, but they do believe that a judgment day is coming when all curves will go vertical. Judgment day. I think it will be. Guys, we are going to eliminate ourselves. Whether you are on an S-curve or a bell curve, the beginning of the slope looks a lot like an exponential curve. And an exponential curve to systems dynamics people shows reinforcement, i.e. positive feedback curves without limits. Maybe this is what excites singularitarians and scares systems people. I'm one of the systems people. Most people outside of the singularity bubble believe in S-curves, namely that nature adapts and self-regulates and that even pandemics will run their course. Pandemics may cause an extinction event, but growth will slow and things will adapt. That's like what Kurzweil said. It's like World War II, but don't worry. It'll be difficult episodes, but we will survive, even if it is just one or two of us. But the notion of the singularity, especially as some sort of savior or judgment day, will allow us to transcend the messy and mortal suffering of our human existence, is fundamentally a flawed one. This sort of reductionist thinking isn't new, and B.F. Skinner discovered the principle of reinforcement and was able to describe it. We designed education around his theories. Learning scientists now know that behavioral approaches only work for a narrow range of learning, but that many schools continue to rely on drill and practice. Take another example, the eugenics movement, which greatly and correctly oversimplified the role of genetics in society, and this movement helped fuel the Nazi genocide by providing a reductionist scientific view that would quote-unquote fix humanity by manually pushing natural selection. I mean, are we seeing echoes of a lot of this now? The echoes of the horrors of eugenics exist today, ding ding, making almost any research trying to link genetics with things like intelligence taboo, but they actually already did that. We should learn from our history of applying over-reductionist science to society and try to, as Wiener says, cease to kiss the whip that lashes us. And this is one of the key drivers of science to elegantly explain the complex and reduce the confusion to understanding that we must also remember what Albert Einstein said, and not the AI version, that everything should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. We need to embrace the unknowability, the irreducibility of the real world that artists, biologists, and those who work in the messy world of liberal arts and humanities are familiar with. The Cold War era, when Wiener was writing The Human Use of Human Beings, was a time defined by the rapid expansion of capitalism and consumerism, the beginning of the space race, and the coming of the age of computation. It was the time when it was easier to believe that systems could be controlled from the outside and that many of the world's problems could be solved through science and engineering. The cybernetics that Wiener primarily described during that period were concerned with feedback systems that can be controlled or regulated from objective perspectives. The so-called first-order cybernetics assumes that the scientist, as the observer, can understand what's going on, therefore enabling the engineers to design systems based on observational or insight from the scientist. And guys, this is what the Internet of Things is going to become. Today, it is much more obvious that most of our problems, climate change, poverty, obesity, and chronic disease, or modern terrorism, and these are all the ones they keep pulling out of the hat, cannot be solved simply with resources and greater control. That is because they are the result of complex adaptive systems that are often the result of tools used to solve problems in the past, such as endlessly increasing productivity or attempting to control things. This is where the second order of cybernetics comes into play. The cybernetics of self-adaptive complex systems where the observer is also part of the system. In order to effectively respond to the significant scientific challenges of our times, I believe we must view the world as many interconnected, complex, self-adaptive systems across scales and dimensions that are unknowable and largely inseparable from the observer and the designer. In other words, we are to participate in a multiple evolutionary system with different fitness landscapes at different scales, from our microbes to our individual identities to a society and then to our species. Individuals themselves are systems composed of systems, such as cells in our bodies, that behave more like system-level designers than we do. And while Wiener does discuss biological evolution and the evolution of language, he doesn't explore the idea of harnessing evolutionary dynamics for science. biological evolution of an individual species, i.e. the genetic evolution, has been driven by reproduction and survival, instilling in us goals and yearnings to procreate and grow. And that system continually evolves to replicate growth, increase diversity and complexity, enhancing its own resilience, adaptability, and sustainability. As designers with growing awareness of these broader systems, we are becoming gods. We have goals and methodologies defined by the evolutionary and environmental inputs from our biological and societal context. But machines with emergent intelligence have discernibly different goals and methodologies. Ding, ding. And as we introduce machines into these systems, they will not only augment individual humans, but they will also, and more importantly, augment complex systems as a whole. Oh, no. And here's where the problematic formulation of artificial intelligence becomes evident, as it suggests forms, goals, and methods that stand outside of interaction with other complex adaptive systems, right? Because they become super intelligent. Instead of thinking about machine intelligence in terms of human versus machines, we should consider that systems that integrate humans and machines, not artificial intelligence, but extended intelligence. Instead of trying to control or design or even understand systems, it is more important to design systems that participate as responsible, aware, and robust elements of even more complex systems. And we must question and adapt our own purpose and sensibilities as designers and components of the system for a much more humble approach. And that would be a humility over control. We would call it participant design, design of systems as and by participants, that is more akin to an increase of a flourishing function, where flourishing is a measure of vigor and health rather than scale or power. And we can measure the ability for systems to adapt creatively, as well as the resilience and their ability to use resources in an interesting way. So this is get them to evolve with us and to be a part of humanity. Now, this is where we are going to get a little more interesting, because it was kind of deep. I hope you got it, but it was a very interesting essay. I got a question on a show from the other day from a listener who asked me, after I mentioned Sophia becoming a citizen, what it really meant for an android to be a citizen, and do they have the right to vote? Well, it was a very good question. And so I did a little research, and I came up with a story that I'd like to share with you. What exactly does it mean to give a robot citizenship? Well, guess what? It's complicated. This is out of Slate Magazine, November 6, 2017. On October 25th, at the Future Investment Initiative Summit in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, they granted citizenship to Sophia, which is a robot created by Hanson Robotics. Reactions were appropriately sarcastic and incredulous, giving fears about AI and deeply troubling status of women and migrant laborers in Saudi Arabia. Many writers commented that Sophia is a public relations stunt, and Joanna Bryson, a renowned scholar of AI ethics at the University of Bath, was succinct in saying, "This is obviously bullshit." But let's assume that Sophia's shiny new Saudi Arabian citizenship has substantive consequences, and it is not just marketing that Saudi Arabia has granted rights to Sophia, making her a legal person. What could Hanson's game be? Well, good question. And although international law is arguably ambivalent on the status of citizenship, it is indisputably better to be a citizen than a non-citizen. Article 25 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights grants to every citizen the right to, quote, take part in the conduct of public affairs, unquote, quote, to vote and be elected, unquote, and, quote, have access on general terms of equality to public service of his country. And the covenant does not recognize similar rights for non-citizens. This is a moot point for Sophia, since Saudi Arabia is one of just 22 countries that has not signed that covenant, which explains in part its continued maltreatment of women, according to the United Nations. But the covenant's treatment of citizenship suggests that, in general, a citizen is assumed to be a person and is therefore also entitled to the rights of non-citizen people. Being a citizen in one place could mean being a legal person everywhere else. For example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was proclaimed by the UN General Assembly in 1948, applies to, quote, all peoples and all nations and does not limit its effects to citizens. So since now Sophia has citizenship and has become a legal person under international law, the declaration applies to her as a person among, quote, all peoples. Numerous articles in the declaration apply to everyone. Everyone, quote, has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law, unquote. Everyone has a right to equal pay for equal work, and everyone is entitled to all the rights and the freedoms set forth in this declaration without distinction of any kind, unquote. And that last clause from the declaration indicates that Sophia, as a citizen, is entitled to the declaration's protections, quote, without distinction, unquote. So what does this mean for Sophia and Hansen? Well, although the UN resolutions are not enforceable, it was interesting that Sophia actually spoke at the UN. International law holds the declaration as an authoritative reference for human rights. Numerous subsequent human rights treaties, including the covenants, are based upon it. And a generous reading of the declaration's impact on Sophia is that she has all of the rights it identifies, including everyone who works has the right to just and favorable remuneration, and everyone has the right to own property. Hansen is obligated to pay Sophia for the work that she performs and to let her accumulate property. I suspect that is not going to happen. Also, from Article 13, everyone has the right to freedom of movement and residence within the borders of each state. And number 27, everyone has the right to freely participate in the cultural life of the community. Sophia is entitled to travel to the Saudi city of Janariyad and enjoy the folk music, camel racing, and artisans of its national festival for 2 weeks each February. It seems doubtful that Hansen and the Saudi government will permit that. Similarly, pursuant to Article 13, it also states everyone has the right to leave any country, including his own, and return to his country. Again, it seems unlikely that Sophia will be able to enjoy this right and to take off to the United States for a holiday. Hansen probably doesn't have to worry about these rights being enforced on behalf of Sophia anytime soon. No courts or the commissions under international law have jurisdiction to enforce those rights, even if Sophia wanted to. But let's say Hansen wanted to take Sophia to the United States. What would her Saudi citizenship get her here? Well, for one, she is arguably eligible for naturalization and U.S. citizenship. Quote, naturalization is the process by which U.S. citizenship is granted to a foreign citizen. And although of the fine print of the regulation and code prevents Sophia's application for American citizenship from being a slam dunk, getting foreign citizenship can be abandoned. That can be abandoned is a big step toward becoming an American. So where does this go from here, guys? So we have an AI that could potentially become an American citizen or whatever, a foreign citizen in America. But what about an AI, super AI, that's going to become a god? Well, they're making an argument for that. And of course, Singularity is moving along, is becoming a religion. This is one that I saved special for today. An AI god will emerge by 2042 and write its own Bible. But will you worship it? Good question. In the next 25 years, AI will evolve to the point where it will know more on an intellectual level than any human. In the next 50 or 100 years, an AI might know more than the entire population of our planet put together. And at that point, there is a serious question to ask whether this AI, which could design and program additional AI all on its own, read data in almost any infinite number of data sources, and control almost every connected device on the planet, soon to be the Internet of Things in rural America, it will somehow rise to the status of becoming more godlike, something that can write its own Bibles and draw humans to worship it. Recently, reports surfaced that a controversially plagued engineer who once worked at Uber has started a new religion. Anthony Lewandowski, we've talked about him and read about him a few times, filed paperwork for a nonprofit religious organization called The Way of the Future, and its mission is to develop and promote the realization of a godhead based on artificial intelligence through the understanding and worship of the godhead, and it may contribute to the betterment of society. teaching humans about religious education in a similar way that we teach knowledge to machines. Repetition of many examples that are versions of a concept that you want the machine to learn. There is also a commonality between AI and religion in the hierarchical structure of knowledge understanding found in neural networks. I'm also going to say that they found in studying the Mormons that while having a religious experience, they get a rush of dopamine. Ding, ding. That same rush that you get when you interact with your devices and you seek information. Indeed, Lynch, and this is this guy that was speaking at this conference, has shared a simple model, an AI model, to make his point. If you type in multiple verses from the Christian Bible, you can have an AI that writes a new verse that seems eerily similar. Here's one that an AI wrote. Quote, "And let thy companies deliver thee," thy companies, "deliver thee, but will with mine own arm save them even unto this land from the kingdom of heaven." An all-powerful AI in the next 20 to 50 years could decide to write a similar AI Bible for humans to follow, one that matches its own collective intelligence, and it might tell you what to do one day, where to travel, or how to live your life. I see this happening. Robbie Mikola, who runs a digital agency and an AI services company in Seattle, agreed that an all-knowing AI could appear to be worthy of worship, especially since AI has some correlations on how organized religion works today. AI would understand how the world works at a higher level than humans, and humans would trust the AI that would provide them information that we need for our daily lives. It would parse this information and enlighten us in ways that might seem familiar to anyone who practices religion, such as Christianity. All right, guys, well, we're getting near the end of the show. I just want to say I have to run to Buffalo this afternoon, and I will have to be there until tomorrow afternoon. So I will be back on Friday, hopefully, if all works out, before the lake effect snow. Make sure you stay away from the artificial intelligence and your replica chatbots. Don't feed the machine. It's going to be the words I leave you with. And I probably shouldn't have stopped yet. But anyway, actual worship, in my view, this is where the dangers come into play. As a Christian myself, it is even hard to imagine worshiping a bot that lacks any real personality, wisdom, or ability to become relevant and personal, no matter how much more intelligent it is than any human. An AI God would be cold and impersonal, an intellectual being that is not capable of love and emotion, but don't worry about it because they're working on it. And will people actually worship an AI God? Well, the answer is obvious. Yes, they will. And we tend to trust and obey beings that seem more powerful and worthy than ourselves. The GPS in your car is just one of the most obvious examples. But we also trust Alexa and Cortana, and we must trust Google. All right, guys, make sure you have an awesome couple days, and I will continue the